I moved to Louisville in 2000, and I came here. I worked for a company that built and managed Alzheimer's care facilities, and I built the Barton House facility here. And I got here, and I got my work done, and I had some spare time, so I came to Locust Grove probably in 1998. Probably one of the reasons that I ended up moving here, really. I've always loved being here. I've really been lucky to have worked here really since I got here in 2000. I've been involved in something through the years here. So today we're going to focus, getting a lot of feedback up here. Today we're going to focus mostly on the project that was installed last summer for the structural repairs, but I'll sort of go through the process that led up to that and then describe a little bit of the work that we did. So this was when I first arrived at Locust Grove in September of 2003, and this was Locust Grove a couple months ago. So things don't really change that much here, really. I think I've got maybe a better color in my new photograph than my old photograph, but it's just a reminder to us that this place has been here for a really long time. The problem that led to the work last summer began in 2009. A structural engineer out of Lexington, BFMJ, had been contracted by Locust Grove to do a structural inspection, and it said that the east, west, and north walls of the house were buckling. Panic. Who wouldn't panic if you heard that, you know, as a board member or a staff person? We were called at John Milner Associates and were asked really for a second opinion. And you need to remember, too, in 2003, this is what the house looked like. And in 2011, that's what the same room looked like. So a substantial investment had been made in the work on the interiors, really complicating any work that we might do in the future. So we looked at the BFMJ report. It was really a visual survey. It kind of limited the amount of information they could get. So we felt like more precise documentation and a fuller evaluation of the causes would really help define a course of action. Carol's not here, so she's I harp on her all the time. There's a thing called a historic structures report, which is a compilation of everything we know about a building. And Locust Grove doesn't have one, and we want one. But everything we do sort of gets gathered together for that in the end. So we sort of wanted to set the standard for how information was being gathered for a historic structures report. But really our goal was to document the condition of the exterior walls, look at the structure in general, provide an independent assessment to follow up on the BFMJ report, and make recommendations for repairs. So we assembled a team. I was with John Milner Architects. We were sort of the project lead. We had Birding Surveyors out of Cincinnati and Robert Silman Associates Structural Engineers out of Washington, D.C. And they're kind of the gold standard on historic preservation structural engineering. They are the guys that stabilize the cantilevers that Frank Lloyd Wright's falling water that were falling. They stabilize them. I mean, they're the best in the field. We also, Carol and all the Locust Grove staff was really involved, Gwen Potts and Locust Grove board. Sam Thomas was still alive. We were able to pick his brain. John Hamilton and the Metro Park staff, Richard Jett and the Metro Landmark staff, everybody was sort of involved in the conversation. Again, panic. So phase one was really documenting what we had, doing some research to understand how we got where we are, investigating the building, and then analyzing what we thought was the best approach for all of this. So we came in and we measured and did building plans, which didn't exist at that point for whatever reason, and we drew exterior elevations of the front and the rear and the sides, and just sort of as a place to get started. So with that documentation in hand, we started looking at the building. We reviewed all the archival records and talked to Gwen and Sam to understand what had happened to the house in the past. So you can see, let me back up and do it again, maybe. So when I pop to the next slide, you'll see like underneath the windows, we got all the brick repairs from when the windows were shortened in the 63 renovation. So anywhere you see brick hatch is work that had been, previous work that had been done on the building. Then we came back and the dark, sort of the black lines are cracks and concerns, missing bricks or whatever, the existing conditions for the house as we found it. Then we layered on, maybe a little faintly here, the interior walls on all the floors and how those might be impacting the exterior walls. Just really trying to create the best picture we have of the existing conditions of the house. Then we took it a step further with our laser scanning. So if any of you are familiar with maps that show topography, I've got a laser here. So this is looking down at a map. Each of these lines represents 1 foot or 5 feet or some increment of grade change in plan. If you look at it sideways, each of these this line is this line. This line is this line. And it sort of shows you the hills and the valleys on a map. So we did that for Locust Grove. So the turquoise line is what we call zero. And the darker blue lines are each 1 inch out more. So any of you that are familiar with the house know that the door frame here is offset 3 inches from one side to the other. And then if you go up this way, the wall leaned back an inch and another inch. This side was much flatter on the first floor, but it had more of a lean up to the eave here. So it was an interesting way to complete the investigation. Yes, these walls are bowing. How much are they bowing? So this laser scanning was so, they gathered so much information that we can look at every brick and every mortar joint. We didn't have all that drafted, but we have a point in time in 2010. We know exactly what this house looked like in a three-dimensional scan. So we did the same thing for the end walls. So here we had a lot more rebuilding. This was to repair hurricane damage from the 1880s. If I look at my slides, I can probably give you better dates. 1884, tornado, sorry, not hurricane. I'm from Houston. we have the same infill beneath the windows where they were shortened after the Victorian era. There was a kitchen addition that was removed on this side. And then there's just been a lot of repointing work that's occurred through the years, smaller repairs and that have affected the mortar through history. We did the same thing. We layered on the existing conditions. You see a lot more in this drawing, these big vertical cracks that go up and down, especially the east side of the building. The question was, are the cracks in the masonry? I'm going to remember. They are cracks in the mortar and cracks in the bricks, both. It depends. If you see them that are really sort of stair-stepped, like here, that went around the bricks. Some of these longer ones cut through bricks completely. Again, we layered on the interior walls. Here we had the chimneys and the fireplace openings. And again, trying to understand how any of this might have affected the movement. And then when we show the topographic map, we have a lot more movement. So again, if we say this is zero, which we just chose arbitrarily, there's an inch plus bulge here. Then we start drifting back to the point that where I believe this one is about 3 inches back. This side from there to there is about 8 inches, I think, 8 or 9 inches difference between the two. And these could have always been there. It could have been built this way. We just don't have any record to be able to tell us if that was the case. So we tried to look at all of the conditions affecting this to understand where we might be able to help or whether we should just leave it alone and call it good. And that's sometimes that's the best approach. But in looking at the building and the masonry conditions, we saw weathering, we saw the effects of gravity, we saw all of the renovation and restoration work that had happened through the years, as well as the ongoing maintenance through the process. So this may answer your question a little bit better. This is sort of a general wall area, and you can see small cracks in bricks and lots of cracks in the mortar just throughout. There's a bigger crack, and we're starting to break up the brick here. The problem with all these little cracks is they let water in the wall. And then in the winter, the water freezes, and it starts pushing things apart, either pushing the mortar out, pushing the face off the brick, making the cracks bigger. So next year, we get more water, and we get more movement each year. So those cracks, that's really the effect of weathering. That's something to be concerned about. On this side, this is the, if you're looking at the east side of the house, the far side of the house, on the left corner, the interior wall is about this thick. And if you look here, you can see cracks in the mortar and in the brick that run the whole way down the length of this wall. So that was this crack right here. And you can see the thickness of the wall. So in modern buildings, we put expansion joints in. In historic buildings, they were all built of one piece. The morning sun hits that front wall, warms it up, and it expands. The side walls are cool, and there's no way for them to give, so that corner cracks. So that's just a weathering, just something that you expect, but you need to keep on top of the cracks. So we recommended that we repoint all the mortar, we repair the cracks, including replacing cracked bricks, sort of stitching across the crack to keep it from coming back. There were a lot of open joints, missing mortar in the limestone foundation. The house has moisture issues in general. We're trying to keep all the water out we can. And then the last one was to preserve any of the character-defining features, such as the grapevine joints, the way the mortar between the bricks is treated. There's some carved graffiti and some what we call penciling at some of the lintels. So if you look at the lintel, you see the components of the arch. They've painted lines over them to make it look fancier than it really is. They would have originally painted every joint. So they to crisp up the elevation, you know, the handmade bricks weren't so formal, but that grapevine joint, you can see the shadow line there. They would paint that white and really create a crisper facade. You can see this was the line of the porch. So all this was protected, and we've got a lot of if you look at the wall, you'll see a lot of the paint and the penciling still there. So these lintels were not properly designed in the beginning. They should slope out more. So really, if we want to stop the problem, we replace this entire lintel. But it's a little aggressive for a historic house, so we're just going to keep an eye on that, replace components as we need to, but not really change the design. Over here was some of this carved graffiti. If you look really close around the house, there are a number of places where someone has very artfully left their mark. And all that's part of the history of the house. We didn't want to replace any of those bricks, obviously. We also looked at the roof. The existing shingles were concrete shingles that were put on in the 1960s. Walter Maycomber, the architect for the restoration, had been working at Williamsburg, and these shingles were designed for use at Williamsburg. I worked here for years before I knew that they were concrete. I thought they were wood shingles. So they were a pretty good substitute, but they had been on there since 1963, and they really were nearing the end of their life. There was damages at the eaves. The gutter, there had been some box gutters that had been removed, and the cornices were rebuilt. That damaged shingles along the way. The gutters were screwed into the front of the cornice, and water was getting in those attachments, so the cornice was rotting. And then when they rebuilt the gutter on the south side, they built a completely different cornice from the cornice on the north side. Both cornices are conjectural. The cornices had been Victorianized, and now if you've seen historic photos, big heavy cornice, big brackets all around the house, those were removed, and Maycomber designed a cornice for the building, and the two sides didn't match. And I'll show you a little bit of some of the issues. So these are these concrete shingles. You can sort of see they really are concrete. The edges, the shingles are being held up by little wire clips to keep them from slipping out. Up here, this is the south side. You see the bottom of the cornice. That is a piece of wood. That is a piece of wood that is set into the brick when the wall is built, and it gives you a place to nail your cornice to, because you can't nail into the brick. But you don't want that exposed to the weather. So in the current project, we've rebuilt this south cornice to match the north cornice, which takes it down to this line, and it conceals the grounds. And then this is the underside of the gutter. There's a bar that's screwed into the cornice, and you can see how deteriorated that was, and there's been a lot of sealant put in there and painted over to, you know, hang in there as long as we can. But we decided it was time to work on that as well. So we recommended replacing the broken shingles or replacing the roof, depending on the cost, installing all new gutters. We were just getting a lot of dripping, and the gutters weren't aligned properly, but especially at the north porch, and then completely replace the south cornice. All right, so the biggest piece of this was the structure, these bowing walls. You saw in those drawings the vertical cracks that we had through the walls. We had cracks at the openings that were, because those lintels weren't sized right, and then we had the bulging and leaning at the two gable end walls. So go back to my image. These are what really concerned us here, these big cracks. And the gable really is a cantilever. There's nothing from the attic floor, which is, let me get this right, first floor, second floor, attic floor, or third floor, the attic floor here, nothing supports any of that brick except the brick itself. So it can move back and forth. It's just standing up there with it by its own weight. Brick works really well when it's just pushing down. It doesn't work too well when you ask it to go side to side. So this is the second floor plan, just for purposes of illustration. We have joists that run, they're embedded in the front wall, and they run in and rest on this interior wall, and then another joist runs here and is embedded in this wall. That happens along the front and south sides. So this wall, this green wall, is being held in place. It can't go in and out because the floor joists are holding it there. The end walls are not being held by anything. So they are running from the top of the stone foundation all the way without being tied in to anything except the corners. And they're really relying on the chimney being a thicker, heavier mass to provide the vertical stabilization for that wall. So that was the design problem. So we go into phase two, a new team. So we had Tetra Tech Structural Engineering here in Louisville built upon the work that Robert Silman Associates had done. John Milner closed, and I became Period Architecture. Metro Parks acted as project manager. David Wilding has been really fantastic to work with. Locust Grove staff, everybody, Carol and Mary Beth, but it was really fun to see how many staff people were out there during the project, looking in the holes. Just their love for the house really was evident. We had a contractor out of Cincinnati, SSRG, Structural Systems Repair Group, and Bluegrass Hardwood Floors were the team that came in to attack this. So our first task was to get back in the house and do some more investigation. We had to locate all of the joists that ran parallel to these end walls, because our plan is to try to attach the end wall back into the wood structure. We had to start worrying about things like fireplace hearths. There's a lot of mechanical equipment stashed behind closet doors. We measured all of that, and we also drew it in elevation. So if you could see through the outside wall on the west side, you'd see there's ducts in this closet that run all the way up, and they're concealed on either side of the window, and then go up into the attic where they turn horizontal, and there's mechanical equipment in the attic. So this on both sides, we couldn't punch any holes in that. We had hearths, which are these sort of hatched lines here that we needed to stay out of. But we wanted to find places to attach this wall to the wood joist inside. So Tetra Tech analyzed the building, ran all their computer modeling, and they came back and they said, we need attachment at all these places. So I use big red X's to make it look worse than it is. But obviously we couldn't put a star anchor, which is the traditional way that you tie buildings together. You would just have a sea of stars. I lobbied for no stars. I know the Locust Grove staff and board lobbied for no stars, but they couldn't really make the numbers work with concealed anchors. So we ended up with 7 stars on each side. So one up in the gable, one here and here, and then 4 each at the level, the floor between the second and third floors. The problem with the star anchor is to make that work, you have to put blocking between each of the joists so that they can't move, which means you have to get to the joist, which either happens from the floor or through the ceiling. And a lot of money was spent on plaster repair, so we didn't want to go through the ceiling. These guys were pretty easy because we could get to the backside of the wall in the attic, so we felt pretty good about those. But these were more of an issue. To solve all the other attachment requirements, the blue dots, we used a super high-tech concealed system that I'm going to talk a little bit more about how we installed all that. How am I doing time-wise? All right. We used a product called a Syntec anchor. And what happens is they drill a hole through the brick, and they drill a hole through the floor joist, and they insert a rod that has a sock over it into that hole through 3 or 4 joists, and then they pump cement into the sock, and it blows up and it grips all of the joists to keep things from moving. So we did a mock-up to see how that worked. And so these would be floor joists. This is the brick wall out here. We've put this pipe through that has this sock on the outside of it. So Mary Beth, any guesses how I make that? There. This is like watching paint dry, but it really is moving. So they've just started pumping grout into this sock, and it's not super dramatic, but you can sort of see what happens. This gentleman came in from Syntec, their engineer, to see how it worked. Our engineer had never seen it before, so we wanted to make sure that this worked. The architect, being me, was very nervous about pumping wet into the floor cavity that nobody could see, so you could see the engineer. We made them put 2 socks on this thing to try to keep any moisture from dripping and staining the ceilings. And they had never done the 2-sock system, so we wanted to try it and see how it worked. And we discovered some problems when we did it. There was too much fabric, and the mortar wasn't getting through really well. But you can see how these are starting to look like a sausage, starting to fill up. And around each of these openings, it grabs that. Instead of putting a nut and a washer on, we've engaged that floor joist and we've tied that outside wall back through 3 floor joists and stabilized the wall. So we ended up having to wet the sock before it went in the wall to facilitate the flow of the grout into the sock. And they also had to enlarge the hole by 1/4 inch to get this sock through. So we did it on the ground, and everybody felt comfortable. So we went inside. We had to get into the eaves on the third floor because we had the star anchors coming through there. Nobody had been in that eave since 1963, but we had been, if you've been in the house, there are these little crack monitors up on the cracks on the third floor, and they move, and there's a little grid that tells us how far the wall moves. Maybe winter it gets bigger or smaller. Those have been on there as long as I've been at Locust Grove. So we cut into the wall, and here's a piece of the wall that we took out. The contractor, this is all gypsum board backup. It's not wood lath anymore. The contractor clipped the pieces of gypsum board together with this steel clip. That is a joint between pieces of gypsum board, of backer board. So the house wasn't moving. We were so afraid that something was happening structurally, it was really these clips just weren't holding. So we don't need those anymore. That was a nice surprise. That's the view inside the attic for the first time in 50 years or 60 years here. And then we put in some little access doors, painted them out, and they're behind furniture. If you look behind the furniture, you can see them back there. But we have a way in there. It helps with squirrel removal, and it also lets us see if there's any moisture damage from the roof. We couldn't see any of that for years. The part that really made me nervous was we needed to lift up the floors to put some of the tie rods that had the star anchors on them. So we went through, measured about six times to make sure we had the right boards, so the yellow tape, the boards were going to attack. They drove all of the cut nails through the boards, and then they cut the tongue and groove along the board we're going to remove, and they did a transverse cut to allow us to, because some of these boards run the full length of the room, and we couldn't lift them up. So they cut the tongue, and then they carefully worked the boards up out of the floor, and they're upset because they don't have their glasses on, and I'm going to give them a safety violation. But once we got the floor open, one of the biggest surprises to me was the interior floors have insulation in them, which we don't, there's no thermal reason to do that. But the house is really quiet when you walk around inside, and this is the reason why. Your heels are not echoing through to the floor below. But there weren't any pictures of this, there wasn't any written record of that, so that was kind of a surprise. The insulation? No, that's from 63. So in 63, they took all the ceilings off. They insulated from below and put new plaster ceilings in. So it has to date from that period. They saved all the nails, which we turned over to Locust Grove for the archive. And it was also interesting, this is one of those ducts that I showed in the outside wall, and there was new framing for those that we weren't anticipating. We had to do some maneuvering to get boards in and out. But really let us see a little bit more of the building that we hadn't seen. Then they drilled holes from the outside all the way through these joists. You can see one right here. So those rods are going to be inserted here. And in this case, they're going to have bolts and nuts, the standard insulation. But this gives you an idea of how far into the house they had to drill in the concealed sockets. There is a tie rod in place and plates to keep them from pulling out. And 2x4 blocking between each of the floors, really making this work structurally as one component. And then those fantastic floor guys put that floor back down. And it was hard to tell which board it was. It's actually this one. This one right here was the one they took. I think the cut is right there. But they carefully, and they put back in cut nails that were a little bit larger than the last ones so we could use the same holes. But if somebody were to take this apart later, they would see a shiny new nail and know we'd done some work. So the question was that this framing doesn't have to, the bolt doesn't have to go all the way through the building. The structural engineer calculated how far he wanted it to go through, but by grabbing four joists and putting the blocking between them, that whole end of the house is working to resist any outward movement. So it's there's enough.
Does it spread the
floors? It does not spread the floors.
No, spread the pull. So the pull, the brace is countermanding the pull. Does
right.
It spread that pull?
It spreads the load across four joists instead of just one. One joist would have just bent with it. So four of them with the blocking creates a diaphragm that works as a system against the wall, but you don't need to go all the way through. You do, if you're running parallel to the joists, you can either add, you know, so that if the tie rods were running this way and didn't have joists to grab onto, a lot of times they'll run them the whole way through the house and tie to each other, or they will put a bunch of blocking in. And, but again, that requires a lot of demolition to the ceiling. But because we had them running perpendicular, we could take advantage of just four of them. So from the outside, what you just saw was really the star anchor insulation. We had to take up the floors to put those plates in. The concealed anchors were a little different process. The guys had to come out and they had to drill a hole through the masonry. At this point, the wall is about 12 inches thick. So they have to drill a 12-inch long, 1¾-inch hole through solid masonry. Then they come back and they drill so the guy's hand is here. There's a drill bit that goes all the way to the wall. It was a 5-foot-long drill bit that he had to drill through all those joists, hopefully not do that, and so completely blind drilling through the wall. And when he was done, we had these little holes. In all those places I showed you blue dots, there were holes in the wall at the second and third floor levels. Then they came back. Sorry, the contrast isn't great here. And they're pumping. This is that hose. There's a tank down here, and that hose you looked at, they're pumping, filling the socks one at a time. It took about 7 minutes to completely fill a sock. And then they bent the end, cut it off, and let all that mortar dry. Then they came back, and they cut this plastic tubing off down inside the brick, and they patched the hole with a colored mortar that matched the brick. So sort of this, I don't know if you can see here, there's a hole with a tube, a tube, a tube, maybe the only one in that photo. And you can also see these areas of sort of bright mortar. They did repointing while they were up on the lift. We took care of the worst of the open joints and cracks while they were up there. On the large cracks where we had cracked bricks, we had to replace bricks to stitch across the cracks. So we tried to find bricks to match. These were handmade bricks, and they're all different colors. The masons made up two samples, same brick, different mortar, and we looked, this is the west side of the house and the east side of the house, completely different colors. And we were picking bricks out of the stack that worked better from one side to the other, and mortar that worked better. And then they spot replaced bricks, just chiseled a brick out and put in a new one all over the building. If you go out and you study the wall, you can see where the old cracks were because you can see sort of an oranger brick path up there. They're going to weather like the rest of the brick and blend in eventually. You can see up here, you can see a lot of brick replacement, the brighter orange. And we looked at staining them to make them blend in a little bit more. But in the end, the staff felt it would be a good interpretation piece to be able to point out, here's the work that we did, explain to people the ongoing requirements for taking care of the house. And I think in this instance, there's a hole. They have not patched the holes yet. I have a hard time out there now, even I know where they are. I have a hard time finding them in the wall. But you can see the star anchor is still there. So this is inside the attic. It's a fascinating place, but it's one of the hottest places I've ever been. But this is the roof peak, and you can see the way that the two pieces of wood come together and are pinned. So there weren't any nails up there. Not many people get to get up there and see that, so I thought that would be fun. But this is the gable end wall. And remember I said that the gable came up and it didn't attach to anything. This is a roof rafter. That's the underside of the deck. The shingles lay on top of this. It just runs right over that wall. So nothing was tying that wall together. This is a view from the hatch in the third floor ceiling to the end of the attic. There's just a little bit of mechanical equipment up there. We have furnaces, we have ducts, we have air blowers. It is an over-under mess. So if any of you guys were around last summer, you know we had to turn the air conditioning off in the building, which is something we don't like to do. But we had to pull ductwork to be able to get in there to do the work and then replace the ductwork. We did one half of the building and then the other half to try to at least keep some dehumidification going on in the summer. But those poor guys had to work up. They came at like 6 in the morning and worked until about 10:30 or 11, and that's about all they could really stand to be up there. But this is what we did on the inside. You can see there's a steel plate here that's attached to the rafters, and then this goes out to that star anchor and holds it together. And down here, there's a steel rod at the bottom and plates that are tying the upper piece together. So we had to, again, there was ductwork that crossed the whole end of the wall. They had to move. We put all this in, and they came back and put the ductwork back.
Is that the original roof deck?
This is the original roof deck. Let me go back a photo. It is full of, you can't really see it, but there are thousands of square nails through it. So we know it had a wood shingle roof, and we still have the nails there. And about 90% of that original decking is there. Well, that could have contributed to these vertical cracks in the wall. If you think about the interior walls shifting and bumping, they're not tied into that end wall. So they could bump into it. That could very well lead to some of that cracking. The first project that I did here was in 2003. They were developing the property adjacent to Locust Grove, and they were going to be doing blasting there. So we came in, and we documented all the cracks through the house, photographed everything, traced on drawings before. We set up a seismograph through the process to try to analyze what had happened. We did not see them exceeding any of the values that are sort of accepted for masonry damage. I'm working backwards because my brain is remembering things. When MSD came through in the 70s, I think it was, and put the sewer lines in, they blasted. And the staff felt that the house suffered damage during that process, which is why they were so concerned in 2003 and we were on top of it. So we can't attribute any of this damage directly to those specific events, but all of those through time are, you know, what contributing to these cracks. So this was a photograph taken, I guess, the weekend before the antiques fair. We are moving incredibly slowly on a roof replacement project. I see today we've replaced the gutter, finally. We've repaired the cornice. All the shingles have been removed off the roof. The whole roof is covered in beautiful ice and water shield, which is keeping the water out. And I noticed they've laid the first row of shingles here. They're going to work a little bit tomorrow, and then they'll be off for the Jane Austen Festival. Hopefully next week we'll have a roof. We looked at every synthetic shingle available. We looked at wood shingles, and in the end decided to replace with the same shingle that had been used in 1963, still being manufactured. We had a precedent for it. It has probably a 60 to 70 year life expectancy. The wood shingle roof was a little less expensive, but not by maybe a factor of 10%. It has a 30-year life expectancy. We can get treated wood shingles that would resist fire, but the concrete shingle is a much better fire retardant. So we decided, we knew that the house could hold the load, which is usually an issue changing to a heavier shingle. So we decided to go with the same shingle from 1963, ordered them from the same manufacturer. The shingles that arrived were not, had not been finished to the level that we wished they had been finished. So the roofer is hand rasping every shingle to take off all the rough edges. So that's about 8,000 shingles that they're having to clean up. We could not get the manufacturer to do any more work on them. So we're very disappointed in the manufacturer. The shingles look great once someone has rubbed every one of them and made them work. So it's going to look funny when it goes on because the shingles are very light brown, but the moss and the lichen that really creates this dark roof is going to happen pretty quickly. So the concrete shingle roof that's there now? No, Hendrix, we talked to Hendrix about that. So the question was, did the concrete shingles have asbestos in them? That had been a concern and sort of popular wisdom. We asked that question specifically because of that concern, and the manufacturer said they had never used asbestos in the shingles at all. It had never been a component, and they showed us their materials lists from when the roof was put on. It is not a component of the roof now. The big changes that they offer now, instead of just a galvanized steel rod in there that sort of gives it strength, they do a stainless steel rod, or for double the money, they'll do a carbon rod in there that will not corrode or rust. But we didn't see any evidence that the reinforcing was a problem in the condition of the old shingles. We did spring for the stainless steel rods in the new ones, so just trying to be sure we don't get that rod corroding and breaking up the shingle. Question is, are they re-roofing the porch? They are not. That is a copper roof, and they came in and they put insulation panels between each of the copper ribs and plywood on top of that so they could work and remove the shingles without damaging the copper roof, and then they'll take all that back off when they're finished. So it's just protective for the roofers right now. Yeah, we were afraid that if the concrete shingles got loose and went sliding down, they'd punch through that roof. So Tim Steinrock is doing the roof replacement, and he has been incredibly patient. And I cannot recall the carpenter's name right now. There's a carpenter rebuilding the south cornice. We had to have special knives cut to match moldings, and but it's up and it looks really great. So I encourage you to take a look. The question is, is the new shingle the same as the old shingle, or have they changed anything, or are they lighter? They are a little bit lighter, not enough to really make a difference. As part of the overall building analysis in 2009, we looked at the weight of the roof and to see if that was contributing to any of the bowing. The roof eaves are bearing on the walls that didn't have a lot of movement. So they're really bracing those end walls, and we felt like the weight, again, brick works well when it's being smushed. So it was holding those walls in place. The engineers ran all the calculations, and they felt that the concrete shingles, we had about another 20 pounds per square foot to play with in dead load for the roof. So we felt good about using that shingle again. All of the other synthetic shingles just really looked synthetic, and one of them directed us to each shingle to bend it before we put it down, that it would hold it down to the roof better. And when I went to demonstrate that to the restoration committee, it snapped in two. So I was like, we're not going to use that one. We tried really hard to see, you know, what other options there were, but it came back that the concrete shingle really, really solved our longevity, insulation, and fireproof needs. The question is the other outbuildings. Some of them do. The kitchen smokehouse stone building has it. The concrete shingle, correct. And we didn't replace those this go round. They're much closer to the visitor. And especially with our experience with Hendrix on the new roof tiles, my guess is we'll probably go back to a wood shingle there. You can really see it. You can't see this shingle from the ground, really. But I think for a visitor experience, I know the dairy and the well, they have wood shingles on them. So the, if I'm understanding the question, you're wondering if the supplier, material supplier, can use this project as a marketing tool, sort of thing. We don't restrict them from doing that. I would love it if they would do this because I'd like a way to be able to go on and have my voice heard somewhere. I've talked to the owner of the company, but he's not going to tell anybody, and he's certainly not going to print my letter of complaint. But if he puts it online somewhere, I can say, here's what we found out.
Well, we moved across the street in Riverwood in 1968, and I immediately started walking on this property, and of course it was quite different at that time. You came in a different entrance, and this over to what is now my left was not there. But I had never thought of this house when we were, when we experienced this, like,
so again, we don't have evidence that any of the damage came from a specific event. The only thing that we saw in the records was that the tornado had knocked off the gable end of that one end. I think there's been some tree damage since then, and some rebuilding of a chimney for that. Part of this process was digging back through Locust Grove files and file drawers and reading. I know that Sam and Gwen had looked through all of that when they wrote their book, but as an architect or as an engineer reading that, we were looking for different things. And I was surprised, and I'm sure there are other files elsewhere of maintenance things, but the paper trail of things that had been changed in the house wasn't very strong. And now with digital collection and digital photographs, we tend to take a million pictures of things, and we can keep better records of that. And I know the Locust Grove staff was in this project every day, taking pictures, posting blog posts about things that we found. We found this giant beetle in there that completely freaked me out. Mary Beth took care of that. I'm trying to think. Oh, the other thing that was interesting, and my pictures don't show it very well. I'll try to, come on. Maybe I should point that way. I don't know if it's going to show it or not. When we pulled up the floorboard, and we did this in each of the third floor rooms, in approximately the same location, so there'd be a chimney running right here, and you have these joists running across. At this joist, there was a round hole drilled in the top of the joist. It didn't occur in any of the other joists, but it occurred in all four rooms. And to drill a hole in 1790 whatever took an awl and somebody, you know, took a lot of work to do that. I've never seen those. I think it was part of maybe building the chimneys, maybe scaffolding that they attached to the frame as they built the chimneys up. I can't prove that, but it's sort of the same question about maintenance and repairs. We can guess. We know there's some damage. We think maybe this happened from thermal change or from the tornado, but we don't have any documentation. That was before I lived in Louisville, but it certainly was a life changer for everybody. I saw another hand over here. Yes.
What was the documentation like for the 63 renovation?
The question is, what was the documentation like for the 63 renovation? We had 11 sheets of drawings, and they had some notes telling people what to do. There were no details. I think it was a very hands-on, collaborative effort between the architect and the Thomas brothers and all the workmen on site. There were not a lot of photographs. Minimal. We couldn't build a building today the way that they did that. And there's still a lot of mysteries to us as architects. One of the surprises was, if I were repairing this building now and I was shortening those windows and putting the brick infill underneath, I would rebuild that wall with brick the whole depth the way it was originally built. In 63, they put concrete block in the back and just put a brick veneer on the front. Well, concrete block moves at a different rate than the brick, so we continually have cracks in the brick that they have to repair. So, you know, the preservation world has come to understand that a little bit better. But that we knew from a photograph and luckily from Sam's memory. And he just walked around with us and tried to tell us things. And we wrote down everything we could because we knew we were going to be losing that resource. But surprisingly little information. Yes, sir.
Do you know if most of the interior work that was done in the 60s was that essentially drywall rather than plaster?
So the question is, was the interior renovation work mostly drywall or was it plaster? So it is plaster, but it's plaster on a gypsum lath rather than on wood lath. So, yeah, and that's how we would do a plaster wall now. Yeah. There is no record of if they kept any of the original lath and did, you know, reinstall the traditional method or whether they stripped it all out. I did not see. There's photographs of it during demolition, but I don't know if it's under there. So I would expect that there's nothing on the ceilings. I mean, I knew that. And I knew that there had been boxes built around HVAC ducts and things like that. But the sidewalls were a surprise. Because all this molding, the chair rail and all that is original, and it all fits together really, really nicely. So somebody took a lot of time to protect it, pull it, reinstall it. Pardon?
Do you think they took it down?
I think the answer is yes, because if I recall that the lath ran up behind it and they mounted to the front of it. Yes, ma'am. The question is there lightning protection? There is presently no lightning protection on the building. I don't recall even if in the Victorian photos, if I remember seeing any lightning protection on it.
Is no one doing lightning protection just because it would mess up the historic look?
Right. So the question is about lightning protection, and does the building have it, or should the building have it? To meet modern lightning protection codes requires a lot of cable. So you have to have certain number of points. This house could be probably covered just from the chimneys. You wouldn't need anything else, but you'd have to have some cables running somewhere down to the ground to transfer. Aesthetically, it could be an issue. We could probably run down inside the chimney, but the other thing is lightning tends to go where there's some metal, and we don't have a lot of metal in this building, so that may be a reason not to do it. I work on, especially when we do slate roofs now, they have a metal ridge and hip ribs that really grab the lightning. We always do lightning protection on those. So, but I think because there's just not a lot of, maybe. Yes, ma'am. The shingles. The question is, the original shingles, would they have been poplar? Most likely, would have just been a local wood. We don't have any documentation of that. We haven't, you know, found any shingles or anything like that. Right. I'm trying to remember now. That porch is a complete reconstruction on the backside. So I don't think there's, you know, because it had been so, building had been so altered that I'm pretty sure there's no original there. And that typically on a roof. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Right, and so we're talking about the porch roof and the original roofing materials for the house. Typically, when you get a real low slope roof like that, a shingle doesn't really help you. So we had tin or some kind of a metal roof covering for that porch, and I have never worked on the porch, so I don't know the history of that well enough to be more dangerous than that. So, any other questions? Yes, ma'am. I would say on the design end, there were probably 15 people through the project. And then for the construction, for the masonry repair project, we had probably seven, a superintendent, and then masons and the flooring guys doing that. And then the roofers have a crew, they have a whole crew out there running on that. But I would say over the last year, there's probably 25, 30 people have gotten some good work. And it's really, the funnest part of preservation is the people who love old buildings are generally nice people. So they're good clients, they're fun to work with. And I've really enjoyed watching the tradespeople that are typically working on a quick construction, concrete block, metal wall ties, brick veneer, to get to come in and really craft something. And the guys that work on this house were amazed all the time. They would come showing us, look what we found and look how this was built. So seeing them engage and remember that craftsmanship is important is always a nice byproduct of working on these great buildings. Yes, ma'am. It was the middle of September. It was 100 degrees in Austin, and it was about 75, 80 here. That wonderful tree at the top of the valley, I took a tour for one, then I went and I sat down there, and I think everybody that lives here knows that there's some kind of a spirit in this city, and I think it's why all the nuns stopped here, and there's something going on here, and it's called me since I came here, and I've been really lucky to get to stay connected to Locust Grove, but that all was definitely part of the decision. I was not looking to leave Austin, Texas, and I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd move to Kentucky, and I've been here for 18 years, and I love it. So, yes, ma'am.
What's the foundation?
The foundation is good. I didn't get into the moisture in the basement. That was another part of this project. The basement is wet. The floors are wet. You can see where water has run across the floor in the sand floors. Moisture is still moving through there. We took moisture readings throughout the basement. I think I've done that four times now. The more times we do it, the more we can see if there's any patterns going on. But the masonry, the walls themselves all look really good. There's no cracks through it. But there is water coming in. So look. There are dehumidifiers and there's a big fan system, and you have to be careful of overreacting. So when I was down there and I was taking humidity readings and getting 85% humidity, we all sort of panicked again, and we turned on all the dehumidifiers and turned that fan on, and we dried things out really quickly, which makes things start moving. So you have to be really, really careful. Yeah, so Locust Grove is in the process of installing more data collectors throughout the house to understand if that basement moisture is an issue in the upper floors. I started working here before all the floor coverings were in place. We don't know if the floor coverings are limiting the movement of air, which would have dried the house out. So I started out with that picture of 2003 and 2017 saying things don't change very much. We don't want them to change very much. We have to be really careful about dramatic changes. So we've suggested putting in a foundation drainage system to try to grab the water when it gets up to the building. We're trying not to come put asphalt all over the outside of the walls. We're trying to suggest other ways that might work. We could put a clay layer in that might direct water away from the building. We saw one of the biggest places where water came through was where they dug the trench for the geothermal piping to come into the building. That wasn't waterproof very well. So it's a big question, and there's unlimited documentation on the moisture problems. Every expert that I've known of and I've come across in my 30 years of doing this has looked at this building and made recommendations. And they're all pretty much the same. They're all pretty expensive. And we just keep saying, is it really damaging anything? Is it affecting the collections? Is it affecting the house? We don't have proof that it is. We're also fighting the urge to spray a sealant on the outside of the brick to try to limit moisture. We think the moisture, if there is a problem, is coming from the bottom up. Now we've asked not to put any sealants on except as a last resort. Now let the building breathe the way it's always breathed and try to just keep the water out. Yes, ma'am. Right, we're trying to be really careful, and we've thought about this whole moisture question is big in Carol's mind, and I know it's big in the board's mind, but we've thought about trying maybe in one of the rooms that has a dirt floor, putting down plastic and just seeing how much condensation we get on the bottom side of the plastic. Does that, and put the meters in that room and see if that affects it. Could it be that analog a solution that we just, you know, put some plastic down and put gravel over it? But yeah, nothing drastic is going to happen. I think you know, everyone's very cautious about making change. So, and there was a question here. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. Is there a structural reason for the two different brick patterns? Because the north and south side have one bond and the ends have a different bond? Have they done that structurally or is it aesthetically? Was it?
So the
Flemish on the front.
Right, the Flemish is a more expensive bond to make, and it shows off. So I live in an 1820 farmhouse down in Hikes Point. The front wall is beautifully Flemish bond. The rest of it is all common bond. I think the issue, Locust Grove had two fronts, and they spent the money on the fronts, you know, the main approach. But structurally, the wall, one bond is not more sound than another. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, and hopefully in the next week or so we'll have a roof.